to Eastern Europe, to Hungary and Romania to be precise. Yet these white Europeans claim to have a special right to occupy Palestine. In this episode of Palestine Declassified, we'll trace the national origins of Zionist leaders and examine their attempt to justify the occupation of Palestine. To set the scene and spark the discussion, we've got this special report from Bianca Rahimi.
There is a rising tide of claims from apologists for the crimes of Zionism. They say they have been misunderstood. Palestinians might be indigenous to Palestine, but the Jews definitely are. What is called the Israel-Palestine conflict is a conflict over the same small piece of land by two rival indigenous people. But how true is this, and what are the consequences of the argument? In fact, most of the power structure of Israel is dominated by Ashkenazi Jews, who have no ancestral link to Palestine. Overall, despite very significant financial and infrastructural contributions from Western European countries, especially the US, UK and France, for example, via the Rothschild family, Eastern European Ashkenazim have been at the center of the Zionist power structure since the early years of the 20th century. For example, most members of the Jewish National Council in Palestine prior to the founding of Israel in 1948 were Ukrainian. As is well known, key leaders of the Zionist movement hailed from Ukraine. Many, but not all, Ukrainian Zionists were close to the Ukrainian nationalist movement. For example, the far-right revisionist Zionist Vladimir Yevgenovich Yabotinsky was himself a direct descendant of Ukrainian Jewish settlers in Odessa. He famously consorted with the leader of the Ukrainian nationalists,
Simon Petliura,
a proto-Nazi responsible for the pogroms against the Jews and others. Arguably, Zionism and Ukrainian nationalism share certain affinities, which perhaps helps to contextualize the Zionist regime's ongoing support for the Zelensky regime. As early as January 2022, Israel began planning to transfer Ukrainian Jews to become colonists in the land of the Palestinians. Israel's Ministry of Aliyah and Immigrant Absorption proclaimed, "We call on the Jews of Ukraine to immigrate to Israel, your home." A later Zionist colonist from Ukraine, who was Prime Minister of the Zionist entity from 1969 to 1974, was Golda Mabovich. She claimed, "I'm a Palestinian," but also denied that the Palestinian people ever existed.
"I'm a Palestinian. From 21 until 48, I carried a Palestinian passport."
All in all, seven of the 14 Zionist prime ministers so far came directly from Russia, Poland, Ukraine or Belarus. The other seven were children of parents from modern Ukraine and or Belarus. Ariel Sharon, Ehud Olmert, Yitzhak Rabin. Lithuania, Ehud Barak. Poland, Benjamin Netanyahu. Hungary and Romania, Yair Lapid. Or Poland and America, Naftali Bennett. All presidents of the Zionist entity, bar three, came directly or indirectly from Poland, Russia, Belarus, Ukraine, or in one case, Austria. The obsession with proving that the Jews, all of the Jews, are indigenous to Palestine flies in the face of the overwhelming evidence of the settler colonial nature of Zionism and the fact that most of those in charge originate in Eastern Europe. Even the Zionist paper Haaretz has published an article claiming that the argument that Jews are indigenous to Palestine swims in fascist waters.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University, and he's a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. We're also joined today by Tony Greenstein. Tony's a veteran anti-Zionist activist. He's a founding member of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign and of Jews for Boycotting Israeli Goods. He's a long-standing anti-fascist and author of A History of Fighting Fascism in Brighton and the South Coast. Tony's a prolific blogger and is about to publish a book titled Zionism During the Holocaust. Welcome to the show. Tony, let me start with you. You've written extensively, haven't you, about the history of the Zionist movement. Do you think many people know the principal leaders of the Zionist movement, or actually from Ukraine and other Eastern European countries?
I'm not sure. Many of them are, but not exclusively. The founder of political Zionism, Theodor Herzl, was a Viennese journalist who worked in Paris. So he was a West European, not an East European. And arguably, Zionism was a West European phenomenon directed at ensuring that East European Jews didn't come to Western Europe, but went to Palestine. So although the origins were in Poland and Ukraine, the brains were in many ways in the West.
Yes, indeed. I mean, I was going to ask you, David, whether it's actually true that Zionism originated in Ukraine. I mean, given what Tony said, I mean, what's your thoughts? Well,
in many ways it did. I mean, the Odessa area in Ukraine was a settler colony where Jews came from other parts of the continent and settled there. And then later, many of them moved to Palestine and became part of the occupation of Palestine. The Odessa was known as being the gates of Zion. Many of the early Zionists came from Odessa. Jabotinsky, of course, famously was raised there in Odessa. And many of the Zionist youth groups that still exist today started in the Ukraine or in modern-day Belarus. So, yes, there is a strong sense in which Ukrainian nationalism and Zionism, which grew up in parallel, had something really very similar to each other. And that's an interesting aspect of the way in which Zionism as a form of nationalism has developed, I think.
Mm. I mean, Tony, it seems that there's an attempt by Zionist leaders to sort of deny those European origins. I mean, is that a fair assessment, do you think?
I'm not sure. I mean, you see, Zionism is based on the idea that it hates the Jewish diaspora. It wishes to wind it up. So it wishes to forget its origins. I mean, yes, most of them, Ben-Gurion, came from Płońsk, a small town in Poland, for example. But they all changed their names to Hebrewize them, and they all hated the Yiddish, the language that was spoken by the East European Jews. That's why they created a new language, Hebrew, because literally they hated the Galut, as they called it.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, we've just seen in the film, David, that many of the Zionist leaders changed the names in the process of becoming settler colonialists, didn't they? I mean, how significant do you think that is?
Well, I mean, they changed their names. I mean, Tony was talking about Ben-Gurion. His name was Grun, Green. And Golda Meir, she changed her name. Almost all of them changed their name. Jabotinsky changed his name from Vladimir to Zev. So this is a part of a Judaization, Hebrewization of them, so that it would appear that they had some kind of more intimate connection with Palestine than in fact they did. And, of course, it's part of the process of colonization to present themselves as being somehow indigenous to the area, just like the attempt to colonize hummus and falafel as being Israeli cuisine. Yeah. These are all part of the same thing. It's part of the process of colonization was the changing of the name.
Yeah. I mean, Tony, does your work on the Holocaust and Zionism help us to understand the national origins of Zionism?
It's a good question. I'm not sure it does. My work on the Holocaust really shows how the main priority of the Zionist movement during the Holocaust was building a Jewish state. What was happening to the Jews inside Europe is very much a secondary matter. Not only was it a secondary matter, but when people tried to find a place of refuge for the Jews who managed to flee from Hitler's inferno, the Zionists opposed it on the basis that, well, if you could save Jews somewhere else, what was the point in having a Jewish state? That was the logic, if you can call it that, they followed.
I mean, David, tell us about Golda Meir's description of herself as a Palestinian.
Well, you saw that in the film there. It's an interview from a British TV programme from some years ago. I'm a Palestinian. And she was Ukrainian. And, she moved to the States and then to Palestine. And she talks about it in terms of the passport that she had between 1921 and 1948. She had a Palestinian passport, and she goes on to talk about how there was no such thing as Palestinians. So she says, on the one hand, I was Palestinian, and on the other hand, there was no such thing as Palestinians. There were only Jews and Arabs, and that's an interesting way of putting it, I thought, because, of course, many of the Jews were Arabs, and this is an attempt to suggest that Jews and Arabs were not the same thing. So there's an attempt here, as part of the colonizing project, to present Jews as being something entirely different from the local people.
I mean, I'm sure the discussion that we're having today will be seen as very controversial by the Zionist lobby, and no doubt will be accused of indulging in anti-Semitism again. I wonder, perhaps, David, how would you respond to those charges, maybe preempt some of the criticisms that, you know, that we're almost bound to get for, you know, providing some factual historical background to this whole discussion?
I mean, you can't run away from this. This is the history of the colonization of Palestine. This is not about about Jews in general. This is about specific groups of people who came to colonize Palestine. Some of them came, most of them came initially from Europe, or origins in Europe, and then others came laterally from North Africa and from other parts of West Asia. And these people were completely different people. They were a completely different ethnic group. Mm. They happened to share Judaism as a religion. And so there's an attempt in this historical process to flatten that distinction, to make it out as if there was only one Jewish people and that they had their roots historically in Palestine, which, of course, turns out not to have been true.
I mean, Tony, you're Jewish yourself, a son of a rabbi who confronted Oswald Mosley's fascists at the Battle of Cable Street. I mean, you know, is this a case of Jewish exceptionalism, do you think, you know, with sort of the way in which, you know, how the kind of Zionist lobby kind of respond to discussions like this?
Well, yes. I mean, Zionism is a movement based on Jewish exceptionalism, that whatever anyone who's Jewish does cannot be criticised. But the essence of Zionism in Palestine was that it was a Western European colonisatory movement, and in fact, they weren't even aware, most of them, of the fact there were Arab Jews. No, and no. Arthur Rupin, who was maybe the most important personality in Palestinian Zionism before the Second World War, he was a social Darwinist. He believed in survival of the fittest, and he had this belief that the West European Zionists and Jews were not Semitic, unlike the Arab Jews. And so, for the hard labour in Palestine, he employed Yemenite Jews. But because of his pathological, if you like, eugenicism, they were paid starvation wages. They weren't given medical care. So 50% of the Yemenite workers died off. They died off like flies because they had this attitude to them that they were the untermenschen. They were not fully human beings.
Well, let's just pause the discussion there for a moment, because we've got another report now that examines the historical origins of the two main groups of Jews in the world today.
Zionists increasingly deploy the idea that the Jews, considered as one indivisible people, are indigenous to Palestine. The term decolonized Judean is used by Zionists, often white Europeans, to describe themselves. But is there any remnant of the original Jewish people expelled 2,000 years ago amongst the two major groups of Jews in the world today? The dominant group, massively overrepresented at all levels of the power structure in what is called Israel today, are Ashkenazi Jews. Recent research in linguistics and genetics shows that the Rhineland hypothesis, which suggests that Ashkenazim comes from the Levant and Yiddish originates in Germany, is unable to explain the genetic, linguistic, and cultural data now available. It suggests instead an Iranian Turkish Slavic origin for Ashkenazi Jews and a Slavic origin for Yiddish. A killer detail in the argument is the existence of, along the ancient Silk Road trade route in northeastern Turkey, of four primeval villages whose names resemble Ashkenaz, such as Ishkenaz. Ashkenazi Jews then appear to have no historical connection to the original Jews of Palestine. The Sephardi Jews are the second main group of Jews in the world. They're increasingly populous, and according to some accounts, now make up a majority of Jews in occupied Palestine. But they also face a well-known pattern of discrimination in relation to the white European Ashkenazi Jews. When they arrived in occupied Palestine, mostly after 1948, these groups often spoke a kind of Arabic and were sometimes referred to as Arab Jews. This was a threat to Zionism, which made sure to discourage their use of Arabic and assiduously worked to de-racialize them. Some left Zionists and anti-Zionist groups tried to present the Sephardim as a benighted ethnic minority. But if the aim is to wean Sephardim away from ultra-Zionism, this is a strategy doomed to failure. Once they become settler colonists and their connections with the Arabs were severed, their primary loyalty came to be the Zionist project. But this cannot erase the fact that the Sephardim are Arab Jews, as is widely accepted in the humanities and social science research literature. Even more pointedly, linguistic and genetic research shows that these so-called indigenous Jews are predominantly descended from North African Berbers and Arabs. The truth is that Ashkenazi Jews come mostly from Eastern Europe, with origins in the Caucasus, Turkey, and Iran. Sephardim are mostly of Arabic, Berber, and some European origins. They are Arab Jews with perhaps as little connection to Palestine as the Ashkenazim. There is no unitary Jewish people with any historically continuous claim to the land of Palestine.
David, what's the background to the academic and scientific literature that's overturned the idea that Ashkenazi Jews originated in Germany?
Well, there's a guy called Wexler, Paul Wexler, who's a linguist at an Israeli university. And he's written several books on this topic. And he's been joined more laterally by a number of others, including a number of other Israeli Jewish social scientists and scientists who have done this kind of a geographical population studies, which have shown the way in which the Ashkenazi Jews originated along the trade route, or the Silk trade route, Silk Road trade route, in northeast Turkey, coming up from Iran, through Turkey, and over towards the west. And the work that they've done is stunning, really, if you look at the data which underlies it, and in particular showing the Slavic origin of Yiddish, which they then say was relexified to German, i.e. most of the German vocabulary was replaced, the original vocabulary, but the language itself was Slavic in origin. So this suggests that the Ashkenazi Jews are Slavic, Iranian, Turkish in original origin, and don't have any real connection to Palestine, to the Jews who were expelled back in 70 AD. So it's a really interesting scientific dispute, and there is a dispute about it, but increasingly it looks like the dispute's has been won, and it's becoming a common position.
Sure. I mean, Tony, what's your view on this debate? I mean, how do Zionists react to the idea that Yiddish is actually a Slavic language?
I don't really know. I mean, I'm not sure that it's particularly relevant. I mean, Zionism makes many claims about the biological, the genetic, the racial, if you like, origins in Palestine. And to be quite honest, it really does not matter. There were 2,000, 3,000 years ago, there were many peoples, Canaanites, Moabites, you name it, Edomites, who were wandering over the land. The idea that you can now make a claim based on a particular group of people who lived in Palestine 2,000 plus years ago is absurd. I suspect if the West Bank settlers met the original Hebrews, they would be shot on sight as terrorists. I mean, that is the reality. It's complete rewriting of history back into time. So I'm really not at all worried about it, because it's completely bogus. Western colonists have always justified their presence in other people's lands by virtue of the Bible or other religious texts.
I mean, I've got to say, David, this discussion about the origins of these Sephardic Jews was kind of new to me. I mean, perhaps you could say a little bit more about that.
Well, again, this is this guy Wexler, who's a linguist, and he's done this research. He's written a book on this, a whole book on it, showing that Sephardic Jews, the word is Hebrew for Spanish, so right. Supposed to be Indeed. Spanish and Portuguese Jews. Right. And actually, that contrary to this conception, the ethnic origin and the genetic origins of these populations is in North Africa, and from Berber and Arabic stock, and some European stock as well, with a really small component of the original Palestinian Jews from back in the day. So even the ones, the Sephardim, who are regarded as being kind of indigenous to Palestine, don't have a clear claim to that, and actually descend from the Berbers and from Arabs. These are Arabs, and there shouldn't be a distinction between between Arab and Jew in the way that there currently is in much debate.
Mm. I mean, certainly this notion of Arabic Jews seems to be quite widespread in academic literature. I mean, what's your take on that?
Well, firstly, I mean, what you call Arab Jews often aren't Arab Jews. I mean, I'm no expert in the different ethnicities, but I understand Berbers are not Arabs and neither are Kurds. But there are Jews heavily concentrated amongst both groups. So Jews were indigenous, if you like, to Arabia, but not particularly to Palestine. They dispersed. I mean, David said the Jews were expelled in 70 AD. I have to say, this is a Zionist myth. There is no evidence whatsoever that there was any expulsion. This, is, again, is history being rewritten back in order to justify a colonialist narrative. So, yes, of course, but you know what happened when the Arab Jews were brought to Israel after destabilization, because Zionism destabilized the community in Iraq, Morocco, etc. They were de-Arabized. They were treated as dirt. You look what happened to the Yemenite Jews. Thousands of their babies were stolen, literally, in the hospital. They were told they were dead, and then they were given to either American or Israeli Ashkenazi parents. And some of them were subject to quite horrific medical experiments. Yeah. I mean, all of this has come out despite three white inquiries. So they were treated as dirt. They were recreated. They were de-Arabized. That is the reality of what happens.
I mean, briefly, David, we haven't got much time left. Arabic Jews, you know, Jews of Arabic origin, do face discrimination. Do you think that, you know, gives us a prospect of a serious challenge to Zionism or not?
I think not. I mean, I think that there is a feeling among some in the Zionist left and some in the anti-Zionist left that might be something to work on. But, you know, I think if you compare it with other settler colonial situations, like especially the question of Ireland, you know, the settlers, especially the working class in the settlers, are the ones who become the most devoted and the most extreme. And that certainly is the case with Ulster loyalism. And I think probably it's also seemed to be the case with Sephardic Jews inside the state of Israel.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there now as we're right out of time. Thank you to Tenny Greenstein and to you, David Miller, our resident expert, for joining us today. And we'll be back next week with more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
الله يا الله سبحان الله الله يا الله والحمد لله الله ولا إله
The supplication, which is the doyan of martyrs, Imam al-Hussein, peace be upon him, has cited on the day of the feast, on the day of Arafah, mostly consists of things which can be used by people reciting it. There are, however, other things which are difficult to use even for noted mystics. Is there any manifestation for other than you? This is different from He is the Revealer. Is there any manifestation for others which you do not enjoy? Means that all manifestation originates from you. Everything is your manifestation, O Allah. When have you been absent that you may need a guide to lead towards you? Never have been absent. All should deduce their manifestation from you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the Muharram and the Ashura. In one of his speeches, he mentioned that Muharram is the month in which justice has risen up against cruelty, while truth has confronted falsehood, and has proved that throughout history, truth has always been triumphant against falsehood. In this part of his speech, obviously, he's talking about the importance of the month of Muharram. And that is true, that this month of Muharram, it's all about the justice. It's all about raising up against the oppression, raising up against the cruelty that we see in the society. And it is something to raise up against the falsehood. And the Islam and the truth is always victorious against the falsehood. And this is what Muharram shows us. This is what Muharram tells us. This is the message of Muharram. And this Muharram is Muharram because of Imam Hussein ibn Ali alayhi salam, the sacrifice that was given by Imam Hussein in this month, especially the day of Ashura. It showed us that how, if apparently the truth couldn't have the victory and it has lost the war, but on the other hand, its consequences, but in reality, which we cannot see at that time, it shows us that the truth has always been victorious against the falsehood. Hussein had the victory against the Yazid, the false thinking that we had in the society. The promise of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is that He gives victory to the poor ones. He gives the victory to the oppressed ones against their oppression and the oppressors. And this is what Muharram is all about. And this is what Imam Khomeini is also referring to when he says that this month of Muharram in which justice has risen up. This justice means that we give everyone's right to and we do not take their right from them. We have to pay attention to the rights of the people. And the first right which we need to take care of is the right of being servant of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And whatever Allah wants from us, we pay that, we sacrifice that thing for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And in the land of Karbala, in the 61th Hijri, we have seen that how Imam Hussein alayhi salam has sacrificed everything, even his life, for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, so that the truth can have the victory over the falsehood.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight. In Britain, the Foreign Secretary Liz Truss has won the backing of former Tory leadership rival Tom Togganhat. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian columnist Aubrey Allegretti. The piece is titled, Tom Togganhat Backs Liz Truss in Race for Number 10. Please stay with us for more of Aubrey Allegretti's article. Britain, the Foreign Secretary Liz Truss has won the backing of former Tory leadership rival Tom Togganhat. In a major boost for the Foreign Secretary's campaign, Tom Togganhat wrote in the Times that her plans for vast tax cuts are founded on true conservative principles. The chairman of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee also criticised Rishi Sunak's fiscal policy, saying it is not right that the tax burden should be rising when people are heading into winter with dread. His endorsement is important as he is popular among Conservative Party members and a senior figure in the One Nation group of centrist Tory MPs. It is another blow to Rishi Sunak after the Defence Secretary, Ben Wallace, also came out in support of Liz Truss. Earlier, Rishi Sunak admitted a video of him as a youngster saying he had no working-class friends was silly, as he defended holding off on tax cuts and claimed Liz Truss's plans would fuel an inflation sugar rush. The Tory leadership contender, who is trailing in the race to replace Boris Johnson, also insisted during an interview with Andrew Neil that he would ensure some asylum seekers were removed to Rwanda, even if it was only several hundred, as thousands more would be deterred. Rishi Sunak faced a tough grilling from the Channel 4 presenter Andrew Neil in the interview on Friday night that was dodged by his rival Liz Truss. Asked by Andrew Neil if there was not something unsavoury about the son of successful middle-class migrants prepared to turn away asylum seekers with a valid claim, he replied defiantly, "No." Though Rishi Sunak admitted only several hundred migrants may be removed under the plan that will cost millions of pounds, he said many thousands would be deterred from trying to cross the channel to claim asylum in the United Kingdom. Among the questions put to him was whether he was embarrassed by a clip aired on the BBC when Rishi Sunak was in his early 20s. It showed the now Tory leadership contender being interviewed as part of a programme on class. "I have friends who are aristocrats. I have friends who are upper class. I have friends who are working class. Well, not working class," said Sunak in the 2001 video clip. Video footage was lashed upon in the race to replace Boris Johnson when it resurfaced several weeks ago, with rivals scornful and suggesting it showed the wealthy Tory MP would not be able to relate to those struggling during the cost of living crisis. Rishi Sunak addressed the video when pressed about whether he was out of touch by Andrew Neil. Sunak said, "We all say silly things when we're students," he admitted. "I grew up working in my mum's pharmacy, and you don't end up doing that unless you interact with lots of people. I spent my time making sure we served our community. My parents worked incredibly hard to provide opportunities for me, and that's ultimately why I want to be Prime Minister, because this country allowed my family to provide a better opportunity and future for me." Rishi Sunak, who several opinion polls of Tory members have found is trailing behind Liz Truss in the leadership contest, was also tackled over his refusal to cut taxes and an alleged U-turn over cutting VAT on energy bills. Sunak had argued against the tax cut in question in February when he was Chancellor, telling the House of Commons the policy would disproportionately benefit wealthier households. On Friday, 29th of July, he admitted it was a blunt instrument, but said it was one of few levers that politicians could pull quickly. He said the apparent vault face was absolutely not a case of poor judgment initially, and claimed Liz Truss's tax cuts, £30 billion to be funded by borrowing, would put fuel on the fire of already spiralling inflation. Rishi Sunak said the move would be a sugar rush that would also push up interest rates and make worse the economic difficulties that many will face this winter. Despite being invited for a similar grilling by Andrew Neil, Liz Truss followed the lead of Boris Johnson at the last general election and refused to appear in the interview with Andrew Neil. At the end of Friday's programme, Andrew Neil said she declined our invitation. Her choice, of course, that invitation still remains open.
It's night, dark and cold. I walk in the city alone in the crowd.
Islamic laws.
Every street, every store is filled with colors and smiles as before. I know clouds are hidden behind these faces. Is there anyone who has a sunny heart? I put on my headphones and play the song, which repeats in chanty whisper. I say, why is my heart set on fire when I hear your
بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. And we would like to actually express our condolences sorrow and sadness for this holy month, the month of Muharram actually, and the martyrdom of the master of the martyrs, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, peace be upon him. Well, we're going to talk about some of the laws related to Muharram according to Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hauza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Well, Sheikh, let's talk about how the believers should hold the mourning ceremonies in the month of Muharram. We all know that we should, in fact, respect this month, and we should, in fact, hold some or convene some ceremonies and religious, services in the respect of Imam al-Hussein, alayhi salam. But would you tell our listeners, would you shed some light on how the believers should do so?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. That's a very good question. The concept of azadari or mourning for Abu Abdullah al-Hussein during Ashura is in fact to respect the symbols of religion and remember the sufferings, the pains, and the hardship that Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam, his companions and his kith and kin went through. And of course we hold the mourning and the majalis to commemorate this great event.
Mm-hmm.
And the month of Muharram actually marks the martyrdom and the suffering of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam in his uprising to defend Islam and to prevent the destruction of the religion by the Umayyad dynasty. And of course, it is necessary to narrate the story of his sacrifices and to acquaint ourselves and our children and our family and everyone with the history and with the incidents that took place on that day, the day of Ashura. So it's first of all very important to listen to those who narrate the event.
Mm-hmm.
There are some very good speakers, some very good lecturers who are rich in knowledge, who are highly learned and who are highly educated.
Mm-hmm.
They specialize in the history of Karbala and the event of Karbala in general.
Right.
So it's important to listen to those scholars to attend this majalis. The aim is to learn lessons from this great event. It's necessary, of course, to avoid doing anything which causes defamation, which causes degradation of the religion.
Or disrespect.
Yeah. It causes, of course, It is necessary to avoid doing anything which is perceived as an insult to the religion. So that's very important. And we should understand what is actually degradation, what is defamation, what is insult, what is disrespect, you see. And in doing so, of course, we should always consult the religious authorities. We should always consult the learned scholars. We should read the risala of the religious authorities, the marja that we follow. That, for example, our audience, everyone maybe follows his own marja. But, you know, when it comes to something being considered insult or defamation, of course, there's no disagreement among the scholars. So why not listen to learned and knowledgeable scholars whose lectures are replete with wisdom, with understanding, and with guidance and rationality, of course.
Right.
So these lectures are even available on the internet. We can download those lectures. And of course, in our convenience, we can listen to them to acquaint ourselves with the teachings of Ashraf. So if there are no such audio or tracks, of course, we can read books. There are some very good books written about Ashraf or on Ashraf.
Yes.
And if we read those books, definitely our knowledge will definitely improve. We will enrich ourselves with wisdom and we will acquaint ourselves with the lessons of Ashraf.
There is
and
a
with
very
everything
good
about Ashraf. That's very important. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes, Sheikh Javed. You know, just to remind our listeners and audience that there is a very good program. It is called Bookshelf.
Good.
And usually it deals with books of religious themes. And not only that, but also it addresses some of the ceremonies, some of the special occasions that may come or fall onto the days where it is broadcast or aired, right? So for that, during Muharram, it is usually, in fact, the par for the course that you know, some of these books are introduced, which are about Karbala, which are about Imam Hussein, which are about, for example, Ashura and the Ashura teachings. So I strongly advise the listeners and the audience of this radio, in fact, to listen to those programs, especially when it comes to those special occasions. Thank you very much, Sheikh. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio after the break. Stay with us.
I work in the night with millions of stars. Your eyes pull me to you. Who are you? I walk in the day with millions of angels. I see you in all these faces. Who are you? One step I fade away, the next step I'm born again. You're flowing in my veins. Who are you? Wherever I get tired, you call me from far and near. Whenever I get thirsty, you start to melt and say to me,
back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Well, we are still with Sheikh Javed about, you know, the mourning laws or the jurisprudential laws related to the mourning of Muharram, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. So, Sheikh Javed, you know, if you think there are any comments left related to the previous question, I guess I interrupted you right in the middle of your words. So I'd appreciate if you go back and continue what there was left from the previous question.
There's one thing I forgot to mention about the first question that you raised.
Right.
I wanted to say that actually Shia is a religion that is known for its simplicity, the Islam in general, and it is rationality. Rationality and becoming passionate, of course, go hand in hand with each other. And in the occasion of Ashura, is an occasion which in which Shia Muslims particularly become highly passionate, you know. And you cannot help being passionate during during Muharram, of course. But there is no objection to becoming, you know, enchanted or passionate. There is no objection to you. But one should maintain his rationality as well. And of course, when it comes to how we should hold the event of Ashura, we need to understand that there are some Shia Muslims whose practice is actually because of a lack of knowledge, because of a lack of understanding, result in the defamation and degradation of the Shia religion. Islam is portrayed as a religion of violence and you know, bloodshed, especially when it comes to tatbir or the practice of, you know, qamazani, whatever you call it, you know. Maybe some non-Muslim media try to portray it as a kind of self-flagellation. I'm strongly opposed to this word, because this word denotes something else. It has a very negative connotation. We do not practice self-flagellation. Of course, Shia Muslims are very much wise, very much, you know, their intention of practicing Zanjirzani, okay? There's much to say about Zanjirzani and also Tatbir. Inshallah, we will cover it in a separate episode, but we need to understand that the main concept of these majalis and these gatherings, of course, which are held in the month of Ramadan, month of Muharram, is to acquaint ourselves with the teachings and lessons of Ashura.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Sheikh, for your nice elaboration of, the laws related to Muharram according to Ayatollah Khamenei. In fact, thank you, my dear listeners and audience, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every breath that you did take, every step that you would make, purpose and guidance it gave, mankind's heart it reawaked. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Guide, you would be in place of Rasul to restore the sacred bridge. Light, you would radiate in the dark and continue the message. When you passed through arid sand, met foreigners of new.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.